Please welcome Paul, who's going to be talking to us about some challenges in infection control. Thank you.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thanks very much, Claire, and thanks to the organizers for organizing this conference, and this is really amazing. It's rare that I go to an infection control meeting that's actually got standing room only, and I'm really impressed. I'd like to also clarify that I'm no longer the international counselor for Shea. I just stepped down, and Stefan Habath has actually succeeded me in the job. So I have a number of financial disclosures. This trip is being made possible by AstraZeneca, but none of these, I hope, have any influence on this presentation. Now, as I tell people, I am an academic infectious disease physician, and what that means is I spend most of my time looking after patients, but my promotion depends on my research output, and my bonus every year depends on the student evaluations. So I'm kind of like torn in three different directions, and I think some of you here know what I'm talking about. So this is a patient that we looked after. He's a 24-year-old pig chaser. Now, does anybody know what a pig chaser does? He chases pigs, absolutely. It's kind of a terrible job. I think you know that a lot of Asian people like their food to be really fresh. So what happens is that every day in Singapore, the pigs would come in on these lorries from Malaysia. And then his job is to chase the pig from the lorry across, like we call it a pig walk or like a cat walk. And you've got people sitting like this, people in front, and they're the bidders. They're the bidders at the hog auction house. And the pigs are not stupid. They know what's at the end of the walk. It's the slaughterhouse. So they're coughing, they're spitting, they're pooping, they're peeing, and it's a terrible job, okay? But anyway, his job is to chase pigs. He was admitted to us in February of 1999 with a four-day history of fever and confusion. He had a headache. He had we found out was meningitis. And like all physicians, what we did was we treated him with ceftriaxone. He didn't get better. We added acyclovir. He didn't get better. We added anti-TB treatment. You know, when people don't get better, you just throw everything at them. On the fifth hospital day, however, he began to improve spontaneously. He was able to respond to commands. He was intermittently confused. And on the 10th hospital day, he got better. We repeated his CSF exam, and it was normal. He was discharged on the 14th hospital day with a diagnosis of viral encephalitis of unknown etiology. Believe it or not, there's an ICD-9 code for that. Our coders actually allowed us to do that. Of course, you know what happened in March of 1999 in Malaysia. The Nipah virus had been described by scientists at the University of Malaya. This is the science paper that was published. And we called him back. We did his serological testing, and true enough, we found out that he was indeed the first case of Nipah virus encephalitis in Singapore. And I got a publication in an Australian journal out of that. So we reviewed his MRI with the benefit of hindsight. He had the classical features of Nipah virus encephalitis. Again, as you know, they banned the import of Malaysian pork. The newspaper writers had a field day with really bad puns. And that was the end of the outbreak. But that's clearly an example of an emerging infectious disease. Again, the Malaysian scientists have shown that the natural host of the Nipah virus is actually the fruit bat. So these fruit bats are carriers of the Nipah virus, but they don't get sick from it. And what happened actually was, again, as the speaker yesterday pointed out, is that we mess with nature. We change the way we get food, and it turns out that what happened was a lot of the farmers had stopped, the price of fruits had gone down, whereas the price of pork had gone up. So they got rid of their fruit trees. But where did the fruit bats go now that the fruit trees are gone? So the fruit bats started falling to the ground, and there was interaction between the pigs and the bats, and that's how you ended up with the emergence of the Nipah virus. It started in Ipoh, spread to Negeri Sembilan in the southern part of Malaysia, and then, of course, to Singapore. Eventually, more than 1.5 million pigs were killed, and the industry was devastated. Again, bad puns from the Singapore newspaper writers. But Nipah virus seems to have somewhat disappeared. If you Google the Nipah virus, you'll get this article from Discover, where they call it the potential pandemic you've never heard of. Well, you guys have heard of it today, okay, so you're one up on them. Now, the question is, what is an emerging infectious disease? And this term was actually coined in an Institute of Medicine report by the Nobel laureate Joshua Lederberg. And he calls it a new, re-emerging, or drug-resistant infection whose incidence in humans has increased within the past two decades, or whose incidence threatens to increase in the near future. So that's a pretty broad definition. And many of the diseases that we deal with are indeed emerging infectious diseases. For some reason, this part of the world seems to be an epicenter globally for emerging infectious diseases. You know, we've had the enteroviruses, we've had chikungunya in the Torres Straits, we've had JE, we've had SARS, we've had Nipah, we've had Hendra. And all of these diseases have had a huge economic impact. So that's been a reason why many governments have an interest in emerging infectious diseases, because of the sheer cost associated with these emerging infections. Some of you have flown Singapore Airlines, and you'll know that SARS was the first time that Singapore Airlines actually ever lost money. So how do we detect these emerging infectious diseases? Now, all of you do surveillance on a routine basis, and the question is it possible to really pick out every single emerging infectious disease that we've never even heard of? And I think for most of us, the answer would be no. So what we try and do is we try and do targeted surveillance. And again, this is a picture I downloaded from the internet of a canary in the coal mine. And I think all of you know the stories when the old-time miners used to take canaries down to coal mines, and the canary snuffs it, it's time to get out because there's poison gas around. So we want to identify those who are the most vulnerable, who can be an early warning for emerging pathogens that are going to appear and cause problems for all the rest of us. Who are the canaries in our coal mines? I think it's stuck. Okay. I would argue that, you know, as you've heard before, healthcare has changed a lot. We're dealing with patients who are a lot sicker, and in particular, we're dealing with immunocompromised patients. This is a cluster of infections. It was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine of a novel arena virus, never been known to cause disease in man. And what happened was the donor of a transplant died from encephalitis, unknown etiology. Subsequently, three recipients were found to have encephalitis, and they died from it. They tested all the conventional viruses, couldn't find it. And what they did was they used a high-throughput sequencing method, and I think Stefan alluded to this earlier. This was done in New York, and they finally identified a novel arena virus, which had never been described. And so in a highly immunocompromised patient, they were able to identify a new viral infection. Again, children and the elderly are also vulnerable to novel infections. And this is data from India, where they identified the Chandipura virus, which is a new virus causing encephalitis in children. If you have the resources, of course, it would be ideal if you could do surveillance of everything. In Japan, they do surveillance of birds, looking out for West Nile virus. And again, you need to tap on the resources of reference laboratories. In Singapore, we use our military, the defense people. Of course, they're more interested in pathogens which have a military impact. And so for other pathogens, we in fact use Queensland as our reference laboratory. Now the question is, okay, so we had this guy who had this unusual infection. And I learned about actually surveillance from this gentleman, the late Jonathan Freeman, who is really a great epidemiologist. And again, I'm sure most of you know this, but he defined an epidemic as an increase in the incidence of an outcome. And he gave an example which stuck in my mind. 20 years ago, I heard it from him, and it's just such a vivid example. The example was of a pathology resident who died. And this is at one of the Massachusetts General Hospital. Now, what is the baseline incidence of pathology residents who die? Zero. So one pathology resident who died, is that an epidemic? Yes, it is, because it's an increase over the baseline. So they had one pathology resident who died, so you've got a case definition. Confirmed case is pathology resident who died. Probable case is a pathology resident who's sick. So you do your case finding. So he found one other pathology resident who was sick. So now you've got one dead pathology resident, one sick pathology resident. Then you do your case control study. So he did his case control study, and he found that the number one risk factor that separated the cases from the controls was taking part in frozen section breast biopsies. Now, thank God they don't do these anymore. Some of you may remember when they used to do them. And what it was, in fact, my mom had one of those. What they do is they bring a woman in because she's got a breast lump. They do a breast biopsy, and they tell her, if the pathology shows malignancy, we're going to do a mastectomy. It's kind of brutal. But they used to do this about 10 or 20 years ago. And so what happens is the pathologist is under a huge amount of pressure to give an answer, you know, within minutes, because the surgeon is waiting, the family is waiting outside. And so what happened was, it turned out that in this operating room, they had turned a broom closet into an improvised pathology room. And so what happened was, the surgeon was passing the specimen to the pathologist. He was rapidly dipping it in formalin in this broom closet, which had no ventilation. And of course, the pathology resident who died from formalin poisoning. So because they did the epidemiologic investigation, because they did the case control study, they closed down the broom closet, put in a properly ventilated room, and there were no more deaths and no more illnesses. So again, I think that's the principle of surveillance, is you want to be alert for situations where you've got potentially hazardous occurrences. So I always ask myself, you know, could we have prevented the Singapore Nipah virus outbreak by working out this one unknown case? And I think the answer is we don't know. So what do we do now? Now, again, as I mentioned to you, SARS deeply scarred the Singapore population. So we have two full-time epidemiologists. They're not infection control nurses. They actually do surveillance of community-associated infections. The infection control nurses have their hands full looking after hospital-acquired infections, healthcare-associated infections. And every day they generate a report. It's a little bit too small for you to see, but they generate international surveillance. They look for the notifiable diseases as well as unusual occurrences. And they do mortality surveillance. And what they do is they look out for anybody under the age of 40 who's died suddenly. And so one day, and every day they send out this notice. It goes to the CEO, it goes to the head of ICU, head of ID, and various other people who need to know. And one day they sent out this notice. A 29-year-old woman who had traveled to Hong Kong had upper respiratory symptoms and died suddenly. So immediately I send out a notice, an email to everybody on the mailing list. I said, you know, this is we need to alert the Ministry of Health as soon as possible, and it seems to be too deja vu. So it turned out that this was a coroner's case. Primary diagnosis, again, viral fever of unknown origin. And so we got the history from the emergency department. We went round to the laboratory, and it's very impressive. The head of our laboratory is a traveler almost as bad as I am, and he was in Frankfurt, and he called down to the techs. He got the specimens processed. We checked with the pathology laboratory, and finally it turned out that she had died from influenza A. But, you know, this was a very useful exercise for us to identify a case, to get everybody working together, and to try and determine the cause of the illness. Again, as Stefan pointed out, there's been a lot of interest recently, you know, not just in these novel emerging viral infections, but in multi-resistant gram-negative bacteria. I don't know if you've seen this video on YouTube of the NDM1, where they argue that NDM1 could kill millions unless new antibiotics are found, which I think is a little bit of an exaggerated threat. In Singapore, it's created a lot of interest in the media. On the other hand, you've got people arguing that it's more hype than substance. The paper itself was published in Lancet Infectious Diseases. There were 37 cases in the UK, 44 in South India, 26 in North India, and 38 authors on the paper. The majority of them were urine colonizations or wound infections, and in that paper there were no mortalities. But again, you know, these multi-resistant infections are going to occur in the canaries in our hospitals, in our vulnerable immunocompromised patients. We have a huge problem with multi-resistant Acinetobacter. And that first appeared, actually, in the Burns unit at Singapore General, which is the national referral center. Again, you know, Burns patients are the most vulnerable to some of these emerging resistant pathogens. But, you know, we get these reports from microbiology every now and again about really strange organisms, and we start to work them up. And it's very important to determine whether we're dealing with a real outbreak or whether it's just something that's just appeared out of the blue. And this was a situation that we dealt with. We got a series of reports of Rhizobium radiobacter infections after surgery. I thought, that's really strange. You know, I've never heard of this bug. And of course, they've just changed its name. That's how some microbiologists make a living, changing the names of bacteria. So we did the line listing thing, and we found out that there were actually 8 patients. We went back to the laboratory, 8 patients with Rhizobium radiobacter infections. They were not from one particular operating room. They were actually from ENT. They were from pediatric surgery. They were from orthopedic surgery. And there was one even from oral surgery. So we're trying to put two and two together and find out why. We did the epidemic curve. We found out that there was one day they actually had 5 infections due to Rhizobium radiobacter. We did simultaneously molecular typing, and we found out that it was a single clone of Rhizobium. So it did look like a point source outbreak. And eventually, the mystery was solved. It turned out that what happened was these were surgical specimens that were sent to the laboratory, and the normal procedure was that they would get sterile water to flush the specimen down into a container. And this sterile water dispenser used to be autoclaved, but somehow on those days, the autoclaving step was left out. And it was just refilled with sterile water. So, of course, we cultured the nozzle of the sterile water dispenser in the laboratory, and it turned out that that's where the rhizobium radiobacter came from. So this is what we call a pseudo-outbreak. So it's a novel pathogen, but it's not a pathogen. You see, none of these patients were sick. All that we did was we delayed one surgery, but there was no significant adverse outcomes because of that. Now, leaving pseudo-outbreaks to real outbreaks, again, as I mentioned, SARS had a deep impact on Singapore. It began with three women who traveled to Hong Kong for eating and shopping, which is what most people in Singapore do when they go to Hong Kong. Early in the epidemic, what happened was the Ministry of Health, they used to hold these briefings. They would get all the physicians, ICU doctors, infection control people together and give them a briefing. Then when the first few doctors started getting sick, they panicked and they didn't allow us to go into the Ministry of Health anymore. I think they were afraid of getting sick from us. So they issued media briefings, a lot safer to deal with the media. And so every day I would go to the little shop at the hospital and spend 60 cents and buy the local tabloid. And that's where I'd get information about the outbreak. They had to make all of us follow the rules, even if we didn't agree with them. And I think it's not moving again. Oh, yeah. Important decisions had to be made, because the bulk of the outbreak occurred in one hospital, the Tan Tock Seng Hospital, which is actually one of the largest hospitals. It has the largest emergency department. And you know that when you have an outbreak like that, you close wards. And in this case, the question was, do we have to close the hospital? And there was a strong debate going on about whether to close the hospital or not. And finally, the decision was made to close the hospital entirely. But you know, this was one-fifth of the healthcare system, so it's going to have a huge impact on the rest of the healthcare system, because people don't stop having their heart attacks, they don't stop breaking their legs just because you've got an emerging infectious disease outbreak. So they closed the emergency department, and then you have patients like this lady who was in Tan Tock Seng Hospital. She was discharged. She was in Tan Tock Seng Hospital for gastritis. She was discharged, and then she got chest pain. But she couldn't go back to the hospital because it had been closed. So she was admitted to us. And when she was admitted to us, she was discharged, and then she was readmitted again, this time with pneumonia. And, of course, she had SARS. So what happened was that there were patients who were incubating the disease, but they were not able to go back to the hospital because it was closed. We've since learned that lesson, and what we do now is if we find an emerging infectious disease, such as SARS or suspected pandemic flu, we would do a no-in and no-out. You can't go in, you can't come back out. Ultimately, as you know, the SARS outbreak spread to almost all the hospitals in Singapore. Most people with SARS in Singapore were infected in the hospital. About 80% altogether were either healthcare workers, visitors, or fellow patients or patients with SARS. We worked with the WHO and CDC to analyze the data. The newspapers themselves did their own investigations. Healthcare worker protection was also a top priority. Again, at the beginning, the CEO of the hospital visited all infected healthcare workers. Now, when I put up this slide at infection control meetings, people always ask me, says, why do you need an N95 mask to answer the phone? And my answer to that is, I think this is something that we did right in the epidemic, because a large proportion, about two-thirds of the healthcare workers in our hospitals are foreigners. Actually, they come in from Philippines, from India, from China. And there were all kinds of rumors going around at the beginning of the epidemic that a Filipino nurse had died, that there was a nurse from China in the ICU. And we had to try and staunch those rumors really quickly. And in fact, the CEOs recognized that it was probably cheaper to buy up every N95 mask in Australia than to replace the entire nursing workforce, or half the entire nursing workforce. So our CEO said, if someone wants an N95 mask to answer the phone, they'll get an N95 mask to answer the phone. I think that's something that did work. And it was highly effective. Once full barrier precautions were instituted, the rate of infections in healthcare workers went down significantly. You've seen this slide, Semmelweis. Of course, he showed that hand hygiene, which again, I'm sure you're going to hear this again and again in this conference, is the most critical step. What we do in our hospital is when we have a new infection control nurse, we do a hand hygiene audit. Because if we use the existing hand infection control nurses, when the minute they walk into the room, everybody behaves themselves. You know? It's a so-called Hawthorne effect. So in February and March of 2003, our hand hygiene compliance was about 30 or 40%, which is about what you'd get in international tertiary hospitals. In June of 2003, our hand hygiene compliance was 90%. So of course, you know, that's one way of improving hand hygiene compliance is to have a deadly nosocomial outbreak in your hospital. And we thought that that would actually reduce MRSA and MDRO rates. But what we found was similar to what the Canadians found, was that there was actually no difference. In fact, there was a small spike in MRSA rates. And it turned out that what happened was healthcare workers were cleaning their hands and they were using gloves to protect themselves from getting SARS, but they were using the same gloves and going from patient to patient, which is a pretty efficient way of transmitting MRSA or multi-drug-resistant organisms. And they found the same thing in the United States in the early 1980s at the beginning of the HIV epidemic. Again, as you know, from this country, it's been shown that soap and water, as well as alcohol-based hand wraps, are highly effective in removing live H1N1 influenza viruses in the hands of volunteers. It's just a matter of making sure that you do the hand hygiene practice. Now, finally, in dealing with emerging infections, I'm going to deal with this question of isolation, because that's always a question that comes up. And the last CDC guidelines came out in 2007. This is a huge document, but it's freely available for download, and I would strongly recommend it for you if you want to. What we did with SARS was they used the WHO criteria for selecting which patients would go to the SARS hospital or Tan Tock Seng, but very quickly we found out that this criteria were not useful for clinical management of cases. So we had to ramp up our isolation ward census. At the beginning of the SARS epidemic, we only had about 10 negative pressure rooms in our 1,000-bed university hospital. By the end of the epidemic, we were running 150 rooms, which were improvised negative pressure rooms. The engineers did a really good job. What they did was they converted all our private rooms, which was not difficult because all the private patients ran away from the hospital. We put in exhaust fans, and we were fortunate. These were the private rooms, so they looked out onto the forest. So they had, you know, we could exhaust to the forest. It didn't really matter. SARS was not killing animals in Singapore, at least. And they put positive pressure in the corridors, and they put little trolleys in front of each room with the equipment that we needed. Somebody put a plastic bag on the computer keyboard. I don't know how useful that was. And what we did was, because we had so many isolation rooms, our rule to the emergency department and the general medicine doctors was, if there's any patient you think may have SARS, just isolate them. You know, don't call us. At the beginning, they were calling us every 5 minutes. We said, okay, just isolate them. We'll see the patient the next morning. And what they did was, during this period from March to May of 2003, we had 4,428 admissions, of which 478 were admitted to the isolation wards. 13 of them actually eventually turned out to have SARS. 465 did not have SARS, so that's a pretty good hit rate. 3,950 were admitted to non-isolation wards, of which 3,949 did not have SARS. Unfortunately, one of them did. And this individual, so that gave us a sensitivity of 93% and a specificity of about 90% too, which is not too bad. You needed to isolate 37 patients to find one SARS case. But as I mentioned, the one patient who slipped through the cracks was the so-called super spreader. He was a 63-year-old vegetable seller. He was admitted as a case of heart failure because he was afebrile. He had new-onset atrial fibrillation. This was his chest x-ray on admission. He was treated for heart failure, and his chest x-ray got a lot worse. So the hero of this case was actually the cardiology registrar, who said, you know, I don't want this patient on my service. And normally it takes ages to get a 2D echo, but he wheeled the echo machine into the ward. He did the echo, he said his ejection fraction is 55%, this guy does not have heart failure. Transferred him to the respiratory service. The respiratory registrar intubated the patient, brought him down to the ICU. Respiratory registrar, despite wearing PPE, managed to get SARS. The entire shift of nurses that night got SARS, two other patients in the ward and two other patients in the emergency department. And that's what we mean by a super spreader. He worked in the vegetable market, so they issued a home quarantine order for 2,400 people working in that vegetable market. And in Singapore, home quarantine is pretty serious. You know, they put a camera in your home. Singaporeans are very innovative. And what they did was they would put a photograph of themselves in front of the camera, and then they would go out and go shopping. So the police had to move one step ahead of them, and they would call you up, and they'd say, wave your right hand. Then they'd say, wave your left hand. And so you can't fool them, okay? So it's a pretty serious quarantine approach. Now, again, when we're dealing with emerging pathogens, we have to determine what kind of mode of transmission they have. And you all know the difference between direct contact, droplet transmission, and aerosol-based transmission. Now, SARS is an example of a droplet-transmitted infection. Our emergency department believes in evidence-based construction. So these are the beds in our emergency department. Now, you know, droplet transmission spreads 3 feet or 0.9 meters. So the beds in our emergency department are 1.1 meters apart. So this patient with SARS was admitted to this bed, and the patient over here did not get SARS because it's a droplet infection. Unfortunately, this patient's wife was standing over here. So she got SARS. Okay, so it proves there is some basis for these isolation precautions that we have. Now, if there's airborne transmission, it's a totally different ball game. And I like to show this slide, which is the last case of smallpox in the world, which occurred in Birmingham. And this was a woman who worked in the anatomy photo studio up here, and she had no contact at all with the virology laboratory, which was here. But she shared the same air supply. So even though she had no contact whatsoever, as long as she shared the same air supply, she managed to contract smallpox. So that's an example of an airborne viral infection. Now, with airborne viruses, the key issue is the number of air exchanges. And it's very difficult to generate large numbers of negative pressure rooms. It's very expensive. But this is a study done in Peru, where they looked at hospitals which were built before 1950. You know, these old hospitals built on a hill, high ceilings, ceiling fans, stone windows, you can't close them. Once you open the doors and windows, you actually have about 50 air exchanges per hour, which is more than you can achieve in most of these air-conditioned negative pressure rooms. And in fact, what they did was they put guinea pigs, so susceptible to tuberculosis, in the rooms of patients with cavitary pulmonary tuberculosis. And they saw that if you were in the new hospitals built after the year 2000, you see that 100% of the guinea pigs got TB within actually a matter of hours. However, if you were in the old hospitals built before 1950 with good cross-ventilation, the rate of TB infection was significantly lower, and many of the guinea pigs never even got TB. So the question is, you know, what with these novel infections, are they airborne? Influenza, of course, the pandemic was hugely controversial. There have been a number of studies which were reviewed in Lancet Infectious Diseases, and only a couple of them suggest that in certain situations, influenza can be airborne. If it is airborne, it's got a huge amount of implications because you have to use an N95 mask. You can't use a respirator. You can't use a surgical mask for airborne infections. So during SARS, the staff were fully protected. We even had these PAPRs, or powered air purifying respirators. At the beginning of SARS, we only had one for a potential bioterrorism incident. Now every ICU, every operating room has got one if anyone wants to use it. N95 masks are so widely available, we even had a bank robber who used it to rob a bank. But they're so uncomfortable that he had to put it on his head and he got caught by the security cameras. So even our healthcare workers have noticed headaches associated with N95 masks, and we're right now doing a study to look at the impact of N95 masks on pregnant healthcare workers. So this has been a huge controversy. In the United States, actually in Canada, there was a study comparing surgical masks versus N95 masks in the prevention of nosocomial influenza, and basically they found no difference whatsoever. This was very controversial. In the United States, they actually had people going around fining hospitals for not using N95 masks during the pandemic. And in fact, the IDSA and Shane wrote a letter, and APIC wrote a letter to President Obama, the poor man, he's got so many other things to worry about. But they pointed out that actually the evidence does not support the use of N95 masks compared to surgical masks for the prevention of influenza. I don't like N95 masks. I've got a letter from an allergist saying that I'll collapse if I use one. And so I use surgical masks, and I only use PAPRs when I really, really have to. I've only used it once in my life. Again, these are very expensive. The tabloids put it very well. In one Singapore hospital, it's $20,000 a day, but it's your money or your life. And so the question is, how do we respond to an emerging viral threat? Do we have to do this every time we think there's a new viral infection? And this is a study that was done by a group of us, including one of our very clever mathematicians. It was one of these cost-effectiveness analyses. And basically, he did a lot of very elegant mathematical work, and comparing the pandemic H1N1 2009, the Spanish flu-like virus, the SARS-like virus, and the bottom line is it depends on how serious the virus is. And again, this is common sense. If you have a deadly virus that's killing doctors and nurses, you really want to take every precaution that there is in the book and some more. But if, on the other hand, it's a relatively mild illness, then you've got the luxury of picking and choosing your precautions that you want to take. So the bottom line is emerging infectious diseases will occur. We can be prepared. It's critically important to do good surveillance, protect our staff, have good data, and have friends, especially internationally. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Just got a question for you. In the Straits Times, you had a women's only section there. It's almost tempting us. What's in that women's only section? Anyone noticed that? Also, I just wanted to reiterate that there's nothing like a good outbreak to get to know people and to bring people closer together so you can discuss the issues.